Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy and Finance Committee to order. First order of business today, Representative Eklund, you have the minutes in front of you. Would you move the minutes, please?
It would be my pleasure, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All those in favor of the minutes as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Next. We have four bills up today, members and testifiers. There's really no reason why we shouldn't be able to get through all four bills, but if we don't, we'll be back here this evening. So keep that in mind. Okay. Anything else for the benefit of the group before we start? Very good. First up today, Representative Hertas, House File 3755. I would move that House File 3755 be moved to the General Register. And with that, Representative Hertas, you have an amendment, the A18. That if you'd like, I'd move that for you at this time to get it in the shape that you would like. Okay, so I'll move the A18 amendment to House File 3755. Those in favor of the A18 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. You now have the bill in the shape you'd like. Representative Hertas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for all your work on Sophia's Law, which we passed in 2016. As is often the case, you find that maybe drag a few people along with an educational effort on saving lives, and we learned that in the case of Sophia's Law. The history was that we did postpone enactment of the law last year, and we continued to work with different stakeholders in crafting and perfecting the law. One of the things that occurred, and it was an unintended consequence, is, for the most part, we were targeting the private boat ownership, and we had kind of overlooked much of the hospitality industry and the rental industry of houseboats. And the way the law was written and some of the standards that we had, some of the information that was distributed, taking a small fleet of houseboats that is common up in the Boundary Waters and in the Chair's home district, is we could have some of these owner-operators having to put in excess of 100 of these devices in a few of their boats, and that was not our intent. And so I want to thank the houseboat industry and the rental industry for working with us. And what we did is we made a few amendments to the law that cleans up what our intent was and changed the carbon monoxide detection system standard. That's what's in House File 3755. You'll find that language on line 1.1 through 1.11. We also added on line 1.14 an installation requirement, and we clarified exactly what our intent was, where these devices should go, and that is predominantly monitoring the atmosphere within the areas of sleeping compartments. So with the changes we've made, members and Mr. Chair, we hope that you'll find this satisfactory, and we look forward to getting this bill to the floor and to the governor before the May 1st start of the boating season. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Meyer, I see you here. I was wondering how the netting, the casting of the net went off the third floor of the parking ramp the other day.
One little snag, but we're going.
Good morning, members.
Good morning.
Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and we want to thank Representative Hertas and Representative Eklund for helping to provide more clarification of this law. We support the changes, and actually it will create more competition within the market to get more of these on, be able to buy probably cheaper. So we're very supportive of that, and we're working to update our communications and education material as well.
Thank you. I want to thank both of you for working on this because obviously it was a serious concern. I know Representative Eklund had some concerns about it. So any questions or comments or concerns, members? Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank Representative Hertas and the DNR for working on this. It was critical. I've got six or seven houseboat operations in my district, and I've heard from all of them. So I'm glad we can get this worked out. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
We can always fix something when we break. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, too, members would like to thank Representative Eklund with working with me, with Mr. Meyer, with the DNR, and I would also like to acknowledge Mr. Ray Strigge, if you would stand. Mr. Strigge is a retired engineer and almost lost his wife with CO, and he has worked closely with me over this last 2 years as an engineer, and he has invested a great deal of personal treasure in having to join the UL standard and the thousands of dollars it costs to get access to those records. And he has been instrumental in this, and I would just like to acknowledge his participation in really crafting the best law that we could with regard to this clear and odorless gas that can kill lives. So thank you.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Representative Hertaus and Representative Eklund, I think this is an example of how the legislature can react to crises when there's a fatality. I only wish we could do that with other situations and move that quickly. I think it also shows that often with legislation we have to keep tweaking it, and so things are generally not a finished product, but you seem to work things out. Hopefully we're at the point here where it'll be saving lives and can make an impact.
Okay, anything else? Okay, so then with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3755 as amended be approved and moved to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? You're on your way, Representative Hertaus. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, Representative Fenton, House File 3660.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I do have an author's amendment. If somebody'd like to move that to get the bill in the shape I'd like.
I will do that for you at this time. So I will move House File 3660 be sent to Ways and Means, and then I will also, and then I will also move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. Members, you have the amendment in front of you. Any questions? Okay, so to the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. You now have the bill in the shape you'd like, Representative Fenton, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So the House File 3660 is related to the recent settlement of 3M with the state of Minnesota. And what this does is it codifies in statute the settlement. So essentially the most important thing to me, and as I hear from my members of the community as I've worked with our other representatives who represent the East Metro, is we want transparency and accountability, because the most important thing that everybody wants is to make sure that their water quality is safe and sustainable long term. So it establishes that, but then it also has a reporting period biannually by March 1st and November 1st. This bill does now match the Senate companion of the bill. So with that, I'll yield to questions, and I will note I do have peace in the valley with everybody. I briefly met with the Attorney General and MPCA and the DNR, and everybody is good with the amendment and the way the bill is right now.
Very good. Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, any comments? Okay, he's shaking his head no. That must mean there's peace in the valley there. Members, questions on this? Representative Wagenius.
Are we going to hear from PCA? And
he's just shaking his head no. You can ask him down.
I think we should hear from PCA.
Well, you can just shake your head no at the table if you'd like to, too, there, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the record. My name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'd like to thank the author for working with us and incorporating some of our suggestions on the reporting timelines and making sure that it goes to this committee instead of the Water Commission, knowing that this committee has the expertise dealing with cleanups, natural resources restoration enhancements, and we believe this will provide better oversight of the work that we're doing. While the account is not necessary to implement the settlement, we have no problems with it, and if it helps with the transparency and the reporting that we were looking to do anyways, we're happy to move forward with it.
Representative Lucky Dance? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you just remind me, I had a few questions the last time we talked about this, and talk about the stakeholders on page 2. Do the stakeholders now include, or has there been any change to have the stakeholders in this issue include the farmers and the others who have had their land potentially contaminated by PFCs? Is that included now in this?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as the settlement outlines, there's a working group being set up. Our goal is to have a straw proposal out later this week to have what the working groups would look like. Our intent is to open it up to the public and include opportunities for public comments. So that would be anyone from homeowners, businesses, folks that work in the area, including those groups that you talked about, will have an opportunity to provide input and participate in the process.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I want to hear the word farmers. There are
farmers.
I want to hear it from the PCA and the MPCA. I want to hear that they are part of the stakeholders, that they understand that those small farmers whose livelihood depends upon being able to produce safe, you know, good food, and whose lives of their families who eat the food and the markets where the food is distributed, I want to hear that they are now part of that stakeholder group intentionally. And I don't know if we need to amend it somewhere. I can talk with the author, but it just shouldn't be vague. And I would like to get a commitment from the agency that it will be specifically spelled out, not just.
Representative Fenton and Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it's going to be open to everyone, including farmers. We'll have a straw proposal out for folks to review, including the legislature, before we formalize the working group. And the intent is that there will be opportunities for public involvement, whether you're a homeowner, resident, farmer, business owner, along the whole likes to have interactions with the larger group.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's what I wanted to hear. I appreciate it.
We like to make you happy. So, I have a question for both of you, maybe. There's obviously a large sum of money that's going into the water quality and sustainability account within the remediation fund. Two questions. How is that money? Who manages that money? And what happens to the interest? If there's interest earned, does that stay in that fund or does it go to someplace else?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll start with the second question last. Under the bill on lines 1.11 to 1.13 specifically talks about the earnings on the investment money to go into the account. So dollars that would be earned because of interest would go back into here. Right now, any dollars that were within the remediation fund or any fund within the state government, the state board investment does invest it on an interest base. Think of your savings account type piece. And so that money is collected on any type of account. And that's what we would see here. We have talked to the state board of investment about other investment opportunities. However, we have concerns that since there's going to be need for this money, that really this doesn't set up for a long-term investment strategy. So if we were to unfortunately hit a couple years of bad returns and then need the money for projects, there would be less than we started with. So we want to make sure we have a conservative investment process to make sure the money is there for the communities.
Okay. Anything else, members? Okay. All right. So with that, I will renew my motion to have House File 3660 sent to Ways and Means as amended. All those in favor, say aye.
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 And those opposed, the bill's moving to Ways and Means. Thank you both. Next, House File 3709, Representative Juergens. The plan on 3709 is to lay that over. And members, I would also say in the previous bill there was a map with the dots on it. That map should be lined up with Representative Juergens' bill that's before us. Okay. Representative Juergens.
To your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3709 has to do with landowners requesting private well testing in the contaminated areas that we just talked about in Representative Fenton's bill with the 3M PFC contamination. With the $850 million that was part of the settlement agreement between 3M and the state of Minnesota, that money should go to help the landowners get their wells tested upon their request. The MPCA, I think they're going to testify. They're doing a great job on the testing that they are doing now. You receive the map to see the locations. But this concern of mine came up. Representative Frankie and I attended a Cottage Grove City meeting last summer, and one of the landowners or resident asked, you know, what's the process to get my well tested? And although I'm paraphrasing, it was basically, don't call us, we'll call you. It was when the MPCA decides that the landowners or the certain wells are within the plume or an affected area. And I understand the reasoning for that. They've got access to the information of where the most likely contaminants are. But I just think that the residents of the area should have a little bit of say in that as well. So that's what this bill does. It provides for the residents to request that their wells be tested, and then also annual reporting to the communities of those test results and to the legislature as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Commissioner Kadelka and then Tom Hogan are here today to testify. And while we're waiting for them to come down, Representative Sundin, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jurgens, I've got groundwater issues in my district as well. They relate to arsenic. I've got another great bill in the hopper that addresses the cost of installing a device under the sink that will actually remove arsenic from the water. Is there any way of, once you've discovered the chemicals in the water, is there any way to neutralize those chemicals or extract them from the water?
Part of the remediation.
Representative Jurgens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps MPC will want to weigh in, but they are part of the remediation process. So, yeah, in-home filter systems are available for that, for removing the PFCs from the water.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can someone address the cost of those remediation systems?
To the testifiers.
Filtration systems.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Valka, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. For the in-home systems, a granular activated carbon system, a carbon treatment system referred to as a GAC, it's about $2,000 to install and then $1,000 for the change-outs, which are about annually to move forward with those type of systems for a whole home treatment system. So they're put on the water as it comes in from the well.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that just address the drinking water or the total, all the water in the system? I don't know about the health risks of just exposure to these contaminants.
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it would be coming from the well, so it would be for the whole home. We'd put it in as where it comes into the house from the well, and then the rest of the use in the house would be covered.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Other than ingesting that, is there health risks just by contact with?
Commissioner or Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Hogan. I'm the Environmental Health Division Director at the Minnesota Department of Health. To my knowledge, it is not a skin exposure contaminant. It's an intake or consumption exposure issue.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it for now.
Okay. Representative Lagunas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the desire of folks to know what's in their well water, and no question about that. But practically speaking, instead of doing individual well testing, if there are areas of concern, shouldn't we be putting in monitoring wells that would help more than one family, but would help all the neighbors, because you're looking at the drinking water aquifer? And so, practically speaking, maybe Mr. Kadelka could answer that. wouldn't we be better off trying to protect more people than randomly testing individual wells?
Assistant Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, if it's okay if I can go through our
sure.
testimony, it covers that issue. And a short answer real quickly is it takes multiple techniques to be able to provide the protection that we as the agency and the communities are looking for. And so with that, as mentioned, I will be referencing this packet here just a little bit. But to start off, MPCA and the Department of Health have worked collaboratively since 2013 to sample drinking water wells in the community. And that includes community drinking water systems, the municipalities, non-community systems, think of churches, parks, those kind of things, and then also private wells. And since 2003, which the first map I'll show, we've sampled nearly 2,600 wells for a total of nearly 12,000 samples. And a lot of that work has also been done since 2016, where we've sampled nearly 1,200 samples of about 1,100 private wells and then additional community and non-public wells. As we've done this work, we've done it by 2009, we were able to identify all the wells that were over or exceeded the health values set by the Department of Health at that time. And then we were working on ensuring that we had a circle where we knew there was exceedances and then buffers built outside of it to keep an eye on so that we could see if there was any movement or changes in the groundwater, but also if there were any standard changes in the future, we knew within the next homes that we would have to respond to immediately and not have to go out and do sampling. And so as a result, our work right now is, and moving forward, is looking at identifying all the wells that are exceeding the current Department of Health guidance values, establishing that buffer around the plume to make sure that we know where there are no detects of the chemicals of concern. We sample wells where there are not exceeding, but near exceedance of the health values, and then we sample sentry wells in low-risk areas to do just what Representative McGinn is just talking about, to have an eye on the area, but not necessarily sample all the wells. And then also work on sampling wells that are requested in low-risk areas as able. So I think just real quickly want to go through a story of Denmark Township and kind of talk about how all these three systems work together. As you can see, Denmark Township is a community right here on the map. It's right above Hastings along St. Croix River. And so a lot of work was done there starting early on in our investigations. In 2007, most of those homes you can see with the yellow and peach colored were sampled once going through, and as a result, we didn't find anything that was over health-based values that the Department of Health set. And you'll see that on the next map, where Denmark Township is the community here with no well advisories. So as a result, our first inclination was to go out there, sample, get an understanding of what's happening in the area. I determined that it wasn't over health-based risk limits. And then we set up a system of rotating sentry wells. We took, with the Department of Health and MPCA, identified 30 private wells, 3 non-community public wells, think again of churches and parks and that. And we are on a schedule of every couple of years going back and sampling those as a sentry device so that we can see if the plumes or any of the groundwater is changing so that we know if we need to do more detailed work within neighborhoods on sampling of individual homes. And that's provided us the ability to work within the amount of capacity we need, but also prioritize the work that's in the areas where we believe there is the chance for exceedances, where we can do that every home in a neighborhood look versus the sentry well. So we'd be very interested in continuing working with the author on this legislation. The things we'd like to really keep in mind is how do we prioritize the work given the limited capacity of the health lab to make sure that those where we have good cause to believe there may be exceedances are done and we're not using it for low priority areas, making sure we can build work with the capacity we have and also set expectations. I think what the representative has heard and we agree we could do better information getting out to the communities, having maps like this, and we're working together to improve what we are providing to the community so that they can see that sampling is being done, and look at their homes to see where they may be in relationship to where we're finding areas that are over the health-based values or underneath the health-based values. And then the last map, working on two, identifying so folks can see the yellow are where we're looking to do additional sampling. In addition, our activities, we're meeting with the contractor today, a meeting that was already set up to increase the amount of capacity we have for sampling during springtime. We're going to see an increase in our activity simply for the fact that we no longer have to ask permission to get into folks' homes and have them be there to sample. We can work with them to check their outside taps of their homes. We get permission that way, and then no one has to be home for it. And we can move a number of samples much quicker than we do during the winter months. So we'll see an increase in sampling in these communities as the weather thaws. With that, too, I'd like to just briefly turn over to my colleague from the Department of Health to talk about the capacity in the Department of Health lab that does the actual.
Director Hogan, identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Hogan. I'm the Environmental Health Division Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. So I'm not with the Public Health Lab, just the clarification, but I have enough knowledge to recognize that the Public Health Lab is working on their processes to improve their efficiencies and be able to do more capacity for samples, especially as we head into the summer months now. Excuse me. But with that said, there's also the recognition that we operate off of one piece of equipment that can do this type of analysis, and eventually we hit kind of a roadblock in capacity there as well. So we're looking at what possible solutions exist to deal with that capacity issue so we can kind of move forward robustly with sample analysis in this area.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. This one piece of equipment, well, why don't we have two?
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not exactly sure. You know, I think there's just limited capacity within the country for this type of analysis. And oftentimes the Minnesota is a leader in doing this, but, you know, it's an older piece of equipment that we have to do this analysis.
Representative Wagenius.
Is this piece of equipment different than your other well testing equipment, or is it the same piece of equipment that you're doing for the rest of your well testing?
The testifiers.
Mr. Chair, I'd maybe ask one of our laboratory people. Call a friend.
Come on down, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Moyer, and I'm the manager of the Environmental Laboratory Section at the Minnesota Department of Health. To answer the question about equipment, it is different than many of the pieces of equipment we use for our water testing. It is a liquid chromatography tandem aspect. We recently purchased one for a different reason for our CDC-funded program, and it was $500,000. So that's the limiting factor, being able to add a second piece of equipment is the cost, unfortunately. In addition to that, we have a processing that gets done with the samples that would require perhaps additional staffing to increase capacity as well.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, following up on that, if we know that this problem is perpetual, I mean, we know that this chemical is not going to fade away. It's not dying out. And as a long-term investment, since we know and the neighbors need to know that you have the capacity to check up on their wells, I'm not understanding why we are not, or you are not, requesting from us an additional piece of equipment.
Mr. Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have requested additional funding for equipment. The triple quad, as we refer to this equipment, is one of the pieces we would like to have. This settlement and this ramping up for additional testing is sort of new, and so we haven't had the need in the past to ramp up to this amount, but we are having those discussions now, and so we don't know what the avenues are through the settlement to request this type of equipment, but we would be open to being in discussions to support the need for that.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, if I lived in the neighborhood that we're talking about, I would not like to hear that there would be lots.
Speak into the microphone, please, Representative Wagenius.
Okay. I would not like to hear that there are going to be lots of discussions about what we do. We know that these PFCs are with us for ever, as far as we know. We know that. We know the plume can change. We know that. So instead of being reactionary and slow, it does seem that it would be wise to come to us and purchase the equipment. And if at some time you want it paid back by this new account, that may be appropriate. But I don't understand the waiting. When all the testimony I kept hearing, you kept saying the capacity we have, the capacity we have, the capacity we have. Well, if the capacity is weak, let's strengthen it. So we have done this in drinking water, in other areas, not having the capacity. So I'm very sympathetic to Representative Juergens, because this has been a continual problem with the Department of Health. And I think we have to understand that Minnesotans are more concerned about their drinking water. So my recommendation would be I don't want to make a recommendation. I just think we've got to think about this differently and quicker.
Thank you. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the panel, I have the distinction of having a Superfund site in my district, and it brought concern to the neighbors because of the plume that was expanding and actually getting into the groundwater, of course. But then as a result of those contaminants, some of them could become airborne, I'm understanding, and they had to get a mitigation plan in place to exhaust the basement air from these homes. I'm just wondering if the contaminants we're talking about today are similar to what I'm dealing with back home, and when I talk about ingesting these chemicals, I'm talking about breathing them as well, not just drinking the water. Can you explain that to me? Are these similar?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, PFCs do not have the soil vapor concerns that we have with other VOCs, volatile organic compounds, such that it may have been TCE or PERC or those type of chemicals. So that our concern is right now is with the drinking water and providing alternative sources where there's exceedances of health-based values.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also had a study done by a high school classroom in my district years ago, and I saw the results of a radon gases in some of the different neighborhoods within the school district. And I was just wondering about the damage to homeowners if they're discovered to have radon or contaminants or whatever, as far as that affecting property values. Are these people aware that there's no way I would buy a piece of real estate if I saw all those disastrous colors on that map? There's no way I would buy a home in that neighborhood. Has anybody talked about property values affected by these contaminants?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that is an issue that's come up in discussion. We've worked with the Minnesota Realtor to provide during the time of sale notification and work with them to strengthen that process so that things such as drinking water system, treatment systems, or vapor systems that you talked about that deal with radon or VOCs are things that the next homeowner knows so that they know of what the situation is in terms of contamination, but also what type of protective measures have been put in place to mitigate those concerns and to understanding that those need to continue to operate to provide the level of protection.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to compliment the author, Representative Juergens, and the two departments on having language in this bill which immediately says not only the property owner but the occupier, and that does take care of some of the concerns I have about the farmers and other renters of the property out there. I assume, what is the mechanism for informing those renters if, for example, the property owner is not passing on that information? There's no requirement, apparently, that the property owner would do that. How do we know that the renters, especially if they speak different languages, how do we know they're going to be informed? Is there a plan to do that?
Representative Juergens or to the testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. What I think that the MPCA can talk about, too, is we're going to have they are going to have public hearing meetings coming up. There's a couple of them scheduled right now, so that's part of the communication problem or communication plan. And maybe you can talk in more detail, too, of what those plans might be. That's a great question that you asked, though, and I'm not sure if I have a good answer for it. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Ready to go?
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could just ask the two departments if they would plan to provide translators there, because some of the people I'm concerned about are non-English-speaking people. Could that be something we could get as a commitment?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we will have to look into that capabilities. It's not something we have planned at this time, but we can definitely look into it. I don't know what resources might be available, and the meetings are set up for next week already.
Mr. Chairman.
General Clark.
I'd be happy to provide some volunteers who might help you if that's really needed. Please talk to me afterwards. Can I just say one other thing? Representative Sundin's question reminded me of the fact that we do know that food that is exposed or crops that are exposed to particularly PFOS do take up that particular PFC, and I'm just wondering if there's any plan to test for that by either of the departments.
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I believe there was testing done on crops or for local farmers or vegetable gardens in the area. I don't have that study in front of me and can't reference it by memory, but that information is available, and I think at this point that's a possibility. I don't think either agency has committed one way or the other.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman. Well, I do know that they had homeowners' gardens tested. And I'm talking about farmers who are renting land around there also having that opportunity to have their produce tested. And I would like to hear that kind of commitment from, you know, the whole team up there. I do have one more question. I was looking at the map, and I see where the Washington County landfill is located. And it appears, unless the map is not correct, that the testing was all done on one side before.
Three you're looking at.
Well, it's the one that was referenced by the commissioner. I was looking at the private well advisory locations. And Washington County landfill is one of the areas I'm most concerned about. And it looks like at least on the private well advisory location map and that a lot of the testing was done on one side of the Washington County landfill. Was the testing not done all around the Washington County landfill is my question, and is there a plan to look to correct that?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the first page of it is the sampling we've done, and the Washington County landfill is at the very middle center. We did sampling all the way around it, including having various types of wells. The second page talks about where we had drinking water advisories, and you can see that's where we found exceedances of health values is below, to the south of the landfill. And the last chart just talks about the sampling we've done in 2016 through 2018. So to answer the the question is, the first chart shows that, and we have done monitoring all the way around the landfill for private wells.
Thank you. Representative,
just a final question. Is this health advisor then based on the current understanding of health risk, or was it based on the previous higher level that was allowed?
For the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, these are based on the current numbers. So we, as they've changed, we've had the issue, Department of Health has issued additional well advisories. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency with its contractor provided bottled water immediately and then talked to them about setting up permanent treatment systems.
Representative Clark.
So, Mr. Chairman, so you've gone back to those areas where they may not have been covered before because the threshold was considered lower and now advise them that they do should be concerned and have the opportunity for bottled water or other filtration?
Mr. Kadalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes.
Thank you.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and certainly supportive of the idea of homeowners and individuals who are in this area having the opportunity to have their wells tested. I'm just wondering if you could, I realize you might not be able to give me a solid number, but an idea of the cost per well to test. You know, as I'm looking at each of these little dots, we're talking about individuals coming forward to ask for more testing. What's kind of the range that we're talking about per well with staff time and materials?
You know, to that point, I would say, members, that we do have a fiscal note that's requested too. Whether or not that shines any light on this, I don't know, but to the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have it for the sampling. We can have someone come down and talk about that, but not necessarily the staff time, but that is something we're working on, the fiscal note, if that's okay to provide them.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Buglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, as you probably guess, is for the individual that runs the lab. First of all, I'd like to say I think that the testing and everything that Representative Juergens is talking about is very appropriate. But I have a couple of questions about the lab. And so you've got one mass spec in your lab and everything else. What's the accuracy on that mass spec?
Mr. Moyer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, our new method that we're rolling out is going to be reportable in our 2.5 parts per trillion. And so how that relates to your question of accuracy, that's where we have the confidence that we can reproduce that level, which is currently about 10 times below any of the health-related values we would be acting on based on the HRLs or HPVs that the department has in place.
Representative Ublum.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Are you using an ASTM test method for this, or what is it?
This method was developed in-house. In 2003 was when we first started developing a method that's evolved over time, and this new method has also been developed in-house. A challenge with PFCs is the methods that have been available, like the EPA method 537, is for specifically drinking water. We test a lot of the source waters we heard today with the groundwater, and the characteristics of the groundwater can be somewhat different than finished drinking water. The other thing is the methods that are available do not include PFCA, and that has been an important compound in the East Metro. And so to use an off-the-shelf method, they typically do not include that, and so we've tailored it to the needs of the Citizens of Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health. Health-based values.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is an in-house test method that you've developed specifically for this. Are there any other labs or states or federal labs that are using a similar method that you've developed?
Mr. Moyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. A similar method, yes, and there's an extraction, and it's using the same platform, the LCTN, the mass spec platform. To say it's the exact method, it is not the exact method. We have shared our method with other states. We do not know if they've implemented it or not to look for it.
Representative Ublum.
Mr. Chair. Okay. So you've developed the in-house test method. And so from a scientific community standard, you're breaking new ground here. Now, how many times is the sample itself tested?
Mr. Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, one time. We get a representative sample collected. We take that, we extract it, we run it through the instrument, and we get a value for the suite of PFCs that we are testing for.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. So you don't report a range. You don't sample two or three times and report a range on this, especially when you're at 2.5 parts per trillion. Isn't that rather typical of lab protocol to test at least three times and report a range on your testing?
Mr. Moyer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the regulatory testing we do for the Safe Drinking Water Act, that is not a typical procedure. We do what's called matrix spikes or spike duplicates to randomly select a sample to test twice to see if the values compare, but we do not generally test each sample multiple times and develop a range.
Representative Ugel.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's a little different. Going back to the samples, when you're testing at 2.5 parts per trillion, obviously the handling of the sample is extremely important. Now, these samples are collected from the field. What's your procedure to make sure that the samples that are collected are accurate, not contaminated, and correctly identified?
Mr. Moyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. From the laboratory's perspective, we cannot speak to the collection process. It's not our staff that collect, and so there's contractors, and so there are protocols in place for how those are to be collected, the documentation that is included. When those samples are received, we have what's called the SCRF, or sample condition upon receipt form, and we document that all of the form is filled out, that the condition of the temperature that's received, that everything is logged in, and then from that point on, it becomes our chain of custody, and it's stored under the appropriate conditions until it is analyzed within what's called the holding time.
Mr. Chair, one further question. Well, okay, so you're not in control of the actual field sampling, so you don't specific, and I can understand that, you're a lab, so you don't specifically know how that sample is handled. But do you know that the vessels that the material is put into out in the field, what is the decontamination procedure to make sure that they're absolutely clean? I mean, at 2.5 parts per trillion, you could have residual in the sampling device.
Mr. Moyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We do purchase the sampling containers at our lab, and they are quality assured in our lab. So we are tested with our lab water to ensure that there is no background when they're sent out. So a representative of each lot is then tested, and then when it's approved, those are made available to the sampling individuals who use those so that there's some knowledge ahead of time that they did not come from the manufacturer with any background in the material.
One further question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're testing down to parts per trillion, which is, we already talked about how infinitesimal that is. But prior to the new equipment that you bought, the new mass spec and everything else, what was your best available parts per million or billion? What were you able to test to before?
Mr. Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it was 50 parts per trillion was our old method that was based on the previous HRL for PFOA and PFOS. And then when the values changed at EPA and the values changed at the state, we then were able to lower it with the new method that we're going to roll out that's going to be tenfold lower to give us that buffer between what we can report and where we need to make the decisions about the health effects.
One for sorry, Mr. Chair. Do you know what the OSHA standard is for PFCs,
Mr. Moyer,
or the, for instance, the hazard communication standard?
Mr. Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I do not.
Mr. Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you find that out for me and communicate that back to me?
Mr. Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Thank you.
Next, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, it's fascinating listening to the cross-examination on sampling. Just because something small doesn't mean it's not significant.
I don't hear that said in the
Well, we've heard over and over again, oh, it's just parts per trillion.
No, I don't.
Well, yes, we've had that over and over again. And the science shows that small amounts can have a big impact. But that wasn't my question, Mr. Chair. My question is, I'm looking at the map with the purple and orange and yellow colors and looking at the Oakdale plume. And maybe this is a question for somebody with groundwater experience, but is the flow, is the Mississippi drawing the groundwater to the river? I look at the sampling that was the Oakdale, the Gray Cloud Township, the Cottage Grove. What's the impact on from the river on groundwater flow? That's the first question.
Mr. Goodell.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just to make sure I got that question correct, you're talking about the Woodbury and Cottage Grove facilities, correct, in the southern part of the map, and those do flow to the Mississippi River.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, so maybe I'll restate the question. Is the river drawing, I mean, can we anticipate that plume is going to move over time because of the flow of the river pulling groundwater or having groundwater flow to the river?
Mr. Goodelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct, the groundwater flow is to the river and into the river with the contamination.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if and when it reaches the river, I'm assuming the soils and the superficial aquifers are similar on the west side of the river. Is that correct?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you're getting a little deeper than my technical knowledge. We can have folks get some more information on that and provide that to the committee. When this first came up, the PFCs, there was sampling done also on the other side of the river and communities to do some of that checking to determine whether it had been making its way through the river and affecting communities in Dakota County.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, you know, with the drinking water wells in South St. Paul, Invergrove Heights, Ninninger Township, Hastings, can we anticipate, or is it a reasonable precaution to think maybe not 5 years or 10 years, but maybe 50 years or 100 years, that we may have detections in those areas?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I would need to talk to our staff in more detail. It is something that we monitored to make sure that we keep an eye on it, but I'll need to get back to you on what our plans are, current plans and activities are monitoring on that side of the river. I just don't have that available.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I was out for a moment. I don't know if the Attorney General's staff has testified on this. I'd like to hear just from them on this bill. I think the private well testing is important. I actually think it probably should be a general fund rather than a settlement dollars, because I think even though the settlement amount is high, it is limited. And this is a long-term issue here. So I'd like a little bit of clarity from the Attorney General's staff about the applicability of the private well testing from their opinion on the settlement. And then also, you know, I expressed at one of the earlier meetings a concern about if we'd gone to trial, a number of these issues, whether it's sampling or whether it's protocols or whether it's decisions, would have been made public. I'd like to know if the materials from discovery have been put on, are available to the public at all anywhere, even though we didn't have the trial. So I don't know if Did the AG leave? I guess I shouldn't have asked such a long question, maybe.
Pretty mean-spirited there. Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair, I can answer the last question. So the documents that led up to the trial, a number of motions and reports done by 3M and those done by the AG's office, our attorneys, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and other agencies are all public records and are still available. So that through the courts, you can see the arguments back and forth by both parties, and those are public documents out there.
Jeff Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kudelka, are those on your website, or are they on the AG's website, or are they, we would have to go to the Pollution Control Agency and look at hard copy? How would the public access that information?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, they are not on our website, but I will check and see how the access comes through the court system and get back to you.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I did see an attorney general hop in and then popped out, so I don't know.
After you're done with your question, you can go out and check with them, and then you can bring them back.
But I would like to know about from their opinion on the settlement.
Sure. Next, Representative Backer. Dusty.
Yeah. There is a the prior testifier. Is he here?
Mr. Moyer?
Yeah, Mr. Moyer. Thank you. You said in your statement, I just have one question, that the source water has different characteristics than drinking water. That's why you had to establish a new testing or a modified testing. What characteristics are different with source water compared to drinking water? Because as we know, they're both H2O.
Mr. Moyer.
Chair, thank you. Well, once it goes through the treatment process, it's chlorinated. Other things are done at the treatment plant. And you get a more consistent community-to-community well.
Can you speak in the mic? You're kind of hard to hear.
You get more of a consistent, cleaner sample, but when the agency goes out and samples closer to the landfill or deeper in the aquifer, I mean, that's the raw water. You're right. It's all H2O to point, but the pH and some of the other characteristics are different in what would be called the non-potable water. And so that's where the EPA, they have the Safe Drinking Water Act methods, and they also have the non-potable Clean Water Act methods, RCRA methods. These are all developed, keeping in mind that the groundwater can be different than the finished drinking water. In fact, in most cases, it is going to be different. And I think that's why we're talking about the well owners, because they don't have the luxury of the treatment plants that maybe the other communities do in the state.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, it would be nice, too, if you could get to me the two different methods you're using. Instead of me just talking, I would like to see the two different methods as possible that you use compared to the EPA. Or if you could just send me a link so I can look that up, that would be appreciated.
Mr. Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To be clear on the two methods, they are both designed to work on the non-potable and the finished drinking water method. There's just a newer and an older method, but we can provide you both of those standard operating procedures if you...
I would appreciate that. That interests me. Thank you.
Representative Hansen, in the cycle of popping in and popping out, we are now on the pop-in, and I see that the AG's office is here, so if you'd like to follow up with your questions, then I'll get to Representative Fisher, Wagenius, and Clark.
Let them identify them to me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Would you identify yourself for the record, please, and then Representative Hansen has a couple of questions for you.
Sure. My name is Alan Gilbert. I'm a member of the Attorney General's Office, and I am the State Solicitor General.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Solicitor Gilbert. Questions I had were on 3709. Is this an applicable or a reasonable use or an allowable use under the settlement for providing the funding?
Solicitor General Gilbert.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, I briefly looked at the bill. I don't know what the PCA's position is. I think it'd be helpful to know what they have done as a matter of custom in the past as it relates to the remediation fund. But I will say generally the remediation fund allows for corrective actions of different kinds and costs related thereto. So if it's necessary to test a well, a private well, I would think the money could come out of the remediation fund, but subject to whatever is the custom and usage and interpretation of the PCA, which is, as you know, is given deference under the law.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair and Solicitor Gilbert, other funds could be used for perhaps general fund or maybe even setting up an account or a revolving fund to do this.
Mr. Gilbert.
Excuse me, yes. Representative Hansen, if the legislature deemed it appropriate to appropriate money for that purpose, certainly we could do that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on a different subject, Solicitor Gilbert, I asked about the documents that were, since the case did not go to trial, Commissioner Kudelka had mentioned the data was public. Is it, are the discovery documents, the materials, are those available on a website, or would we need to go look at hard copy? How may the public access that information?
Mr. Gilbert.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hansen, there's a number of moving parts to that question in terms of the answer. There's a protective order in the case, which is very common, and the protective order provides that within 60 days after the culmination of the case, that would be February 20th when the case settled, that all confidential documents have to be returned or destroyed under the protective order the court issued. And again, that's very common for courts to do that. What we're in the process of doing right now is trying to separate the public documents from the confidential documents. And under the protective order, as long as 3M marks something as confidential, it is deemed to be confidential for purposes of the protective order. Now, through the process of the litigation, we have challenged a lot of the confidential designations of 3M, and for purposes of our exhibit list, the documents we intended to use for trial that have been identified. And all but there's hundreds of documents that we intended to use as exhibits. All but seven have been deemed to be public by 3M and the court. As to the remaining 26 or 27 million pages of documents, we're going through that right now, trying to separate the public from the confidential. In terms of access to the documents right now, the documents that were on our exhibit list, and they're in the hundreds, if not more than that, are on the Attorney General's website right now that are public. So they're accessible in that way. And we intend to make all public documents accessible as soon as we can ferret out the differences between the confidential and the public document.
How tall is a stack of 26 million? I'll forget it.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answered my question.
All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are centering a little bit more on wells and what is happening from the first settlement that the state had with 3M that was supposed to help contain the plume. I know that there was under the first settlement, there was not only testing done, but also monitoring wells or wells put in that would try to control the plumes out there. Where does that show up on the maps that we have here? How effective is that? And what are the test wells showing in the area right now in terms of is it preventing it from spreading? Is it reducing the areas that it's getting into, et cetera?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll take the first question on terms of the consent order. You're talking about the 2007 consent order that was reached between MPCA and the state and, mm-hmm. and 3M. The dollars for those activities are what are covering the sampling done for the private homes here. What we do is the MPCA will do the work through our contractors and the Department of Health lab, and then annually we would have those charges or expenses charged back to 3M, and they would cover those costs. So that's the work that's being done here. On the sites themselves and the monitoring wells around them, those are costs that 3M covered under their own efforts through the consent order. And the last part of your question there is the outcome of those wells around the disposal sites. I'll need to ask a colleague down to help me with that one.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another part of the question I have is in terms of wells, I understand that there were wells put in the aquifer to try to control the spread of the plume. Wanted to know what area that was kind of targeted on the map, where we're looking at in those areas.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative, Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, those are around the disposal sites, and I'm going to have my colleague here and just talk a little bit about what is occurring around those disposal sites.
Good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Krieger. I'm a supervisor in the MPCA's Superfund program, and I've been dealing with either as a project manager or supervisor with the 3M sites since 2004. And under the terms of the settlement agreement, the consent order back in 2007, 3M implemented a number of actions at each of the sites, including, you know, excavation of contaminated soil, but also installation of barrier wells at the site. So the sites would be at the Oakdale site, at the Woodbury site, and then also at the Cottage Grove site, where these barrier wells are designed to contain the contaminated groundwater from exiting the site, so to speak. And those barrier wells are also pumped out and also treated with carbon to remove the PFCs from the contaminated groundwater. So those are containing the contaminated groundwater each of the sites from leaving the site and thus, you know, adding to the contamination problem off the site.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When that groundwater is pumped out and treated, is it injected back in the ground? Is it released? What ends up happening to that water?
Mr. Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. The groundwater is treated at the Oakdale site. It's treated with carbon and then discharged to the municipal sanitary sewer system. The water at the Woodbury and Cottage Grove sites are treated, and also then that water is reused at the Cottage Grove plant and then goes through their wastewater treatment system at the Cottage Grove plant and treated again before discharge to the Mississippi River.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions that come off that is, in terms of the contaminants that are collected, then what happened to the contaminants that they do remove?
Mr. Krieger.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm assuming the understanding is the groundwater is treated with carbon, and then the carbon is, goes through a regeneration process and destroys. So the carbon, basically the treatment process of the carbon basically destroys the PFCs that are in the carbon. And then, of course, the water that's discharged is also treated, so that is also free of the PFCs before it's discharged.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question I have is it sounds like we're removing a lot of water. Do you have an idea between all of the wells that are taking water out from the Oakdale to the Woodbury site, et cetera, what that total amount of water that's being pumped out is?
Mr. Krieger.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I believe the groundwater that's pumped out, for example, at the Woodbury site is around 4 million gallons a day, I do believe. That's piped down to the Cottage Grove plant, treated and used at the plant. Offhand, I do not recall what the groundwater amount at Oakdale is. I can get that for you if you want to. But it's not in the same amounts as treated at Oakdale.
Representative Fisher.
4 million a day. I'm sorry, I can't do the math. We're talking billions of gallons a year.
Mr. Krieger.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's 4 million gallons a day is pumped out at Woodbury.
Kind of as a reference.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a reference point around the White Bear Lake area. We were fighting when it went from 1 billion gallons a year in the total area being pumped to 4 billion a year. So this is just to highlight how much water is being pumped out of that. That is just going down and in many cases out to the river, which kind of hits our water sustainability efforts in the area.
Thank you. We have one bill left today, too, yet, folks. Representative Wagenius. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Kadelka, just following up on Representative Hansen's question about the movement of the plume, and he asked, you said you'd give him some information, but I think we should all have some information about how you are projecting that movement. And the reason I'm thinking about it is there are well, let's use Mankato as an example. Mankato is having trouble with its wells right now because of pollution, contamination coming in from the Blue Earth and coming in from the Minnesota River. And so they are going to need a treatment system. Similarly, Hastings is going to need a treatment system because its wells are contaminated, likely from groundwater. So as they are thinking about developing a treatment plant, should they be anticipating that they're also going to have to do PFCs before the life of that plant is over? And if so, we should tell them, and that should be part of the whole settlement issue. So I think we do need to have a really good understanding of the movement of that plume, because it's going, if it is going downriver, there are other people who use not the river, but the river can contaminate the groundwater that is the wells. Or I can think of the city of Hastings, but there are probably others too.
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we will provide a more all-encompassing response back to yours and Representative Hanson's on that, in addition to just the sampling that's been done on the Dakota County side of the communities there, but the nature of the plume and interactions with the river.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, well, I was done, but then we had good questions from both sides, so I have a couple more questions to ask. So one of them has to do with this whole issue of plumes and the water flowing towards the river and the lakes that are in the area. And I'm just wondering, I know that we had fish advisories at some point, and I believe they were on the Mississippi and I think also Lake Jane and maybe some other lakes because of PFCs. Can I get an update on that, where we are with the fish advisories for the fish that are contaminated in the rivers and lakes due to this dam problem?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the previous response, we provided data on the fish sampling that Department of Health has done, but we will get you specific data also on the fish advisors. We just don't have those at our fingertips right now.
Mr. Chair, Mark. Thank you. I think it's really important that we all know about that, because we have a lot of people who fish the river and who fish the lakes, and there used to be, I think I've had a discussion with the Department of Health about this, there used to be fish advisories that were posted in some of these places, and I believe that's not happening anymore, perhaps due to lack of funding or some other reason, but they were posted in several languages. And so when you give me that information, probably working with the Department of Health, unless they're here and can comment today, I guess I'd like to know what we have in place, if anything, right now. Maybe, is there anybody from the Department of Health who could comment on that right now?
Mr. Hogan? Thank you, Mr. Hogan. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I don't have that information in front of me as far as what information is posted at boat landings and other fishing areas in the area. And I know we've attempted to provide information in language specific situations when we do provide that information.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I would just ask that the whole committee gets informed about that information. I think it's important to all of our constituents. And maybe this is a question for you as well. The question was asked earlier about the OSHA standards. And I'm just wondering, as we were talking about information being destroyed in the settlement, one of the pieces of information that I'm pretty concerned about is the testing, the occupational testing that 3M may or may not have done with its own workers. I understand that other places, other workers where PFCs have been manufactured, there have been serious health problems. And I'm just wondering, again, if anyone can say, is that information about the testing that was done in our own state, our own workers there, is that part of what's going to be destroyed, or is that going to be some way protected?
Commissioner Kudelka, or AG's office, maybe?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Moyer.
Representative Clark, to my knowledge, 3M has done a number of studies in regards to worker exposure, so I'm not exactly sure their process for maintaining the specific worker data at the end of those studies.
Mr. Chairman,
yep.
Maybe if,
Clark.
If our agencies could check into that and get back to us, because one of the things we know is sometimes there's immediate health implications, sometimes it's long-term, and if the data is destroyed, that's a problem. And so I'd like to just know if that data is part of the settlement, that it either could be preserved, or if not, could we look at that and maybe request that it be preserved?
Yes, sure. Testifiers? Mr. Hogan?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we'll check with the Attorney General's office and find out where that is, what bucket that is.
Thank you. Okay. That's it. And nothing else here, members? Representative Juergens, a quick closing comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We've talked about plumes, lab equipment, testing procedures, lab capacity, the settlement agreement, land values, and prior results. I want to thank you all for the great questions and for the testifiers that have provided the answers. But I want to bring you back to the nature of this bill. This bill allows the residents in my district, in the affected area, a means to have their lab or their wells tested at their request. The people in my district, people in the affected area, they're concerned. They're concerned about their health. They're concerned about the impact it might have on their children. And so I don't think it's asking too much to allow them to have a little bit of peace of mind to have that lab or to have the labs test their wells. And I look forward to working with Mr. Kadelka and the MPCA to make sure that we get this right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Juergens. I appreciate the concerns that people have about the situation. I'm glad that you brought us back to your bill. And with that, House File 3709 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, people. Okay, next, Mr. Kadelka and Greta Gauthier, come down, please. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, while the testifiers on the next bill are coming down, thank you. Just wanted to mention today is the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association legislative reception. And, of course, chronic wasting disease is still, really at a crisis. I'm wondering if there's a plan to get Representative Hoppe's bill or Representative Hansen's bills heard before deadline.
I've met with Representative Hoppe, and we talked about that. It's his bill. I'll let Representative Hoppe respond to that right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Beckerfin. I'm happy with the progress we're making. At least the Board of Animal Health and the DNR are moving. I don't know that they're going to get anything done before we're done here in session, but at least they're talking about it. I just spoke to Mr. Meyer from the DMR earlier this morning, and I think we can get something done here. And if we can't, then we need to move forward with legislation. Chronic wasting disease isn't going away. I've been talking about this for a long time, and I'm glad that it's getting to the point where it looks like it's being taken more seriously. So thank you for your interest.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the legislative auditor report is conveniently coming in after deadline, which is really so I just would encourage you to think about at least getting the first hearing in so that we can act if we need to instead of waiting for next session. So thank you.
Thank you. I would never question the orders of the legislative auditor myself, but okay. Next, House File 3666. And I would make a motion to send House File 3666 to GovOps. And members, I wish I was as effective a legislator as Representative Fenton is, because she had peace in the valley on her bill, and we do not on the majority of this bill with regards to the e-waste. And I know Representative Hornstein and I have worked on this a fair amount together. And we just kind of chased people into a room and said, see what you can work out. And when you've got something put together, come see us. Well, we don't have that here. So I'm going to move the A2 amendment. You have that before you, which actually then is going to delete pages 1 through 8, sections 1 through 5. And if you take a look at the bill, then on page 8, that just leaves line 8.7. To the end of the bill on line 9.2, that's what would be left of this bill. So I'll move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, the amendment is adopted. Thank you. Ms. Gauthier and Mr. Benke, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to walk the committee just through the remaining sections of the bill briefly.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is the MPCA's technical policy bill for this year. It's quite short, but we believe these are important provisions and would like your support. So on page 8, line 7, sections 6 and 7 are the first part of what we are proposing. So this is related to our small business environmental loans program. This is a program that provides loans to small businesses for to allow them to meet environmental regulations or to do the necessary cleanups they need to do to meet rules and regulations. This was created in 1997, and the terms and eligibility criteria for the program have not been updated since 1997, and that's what we'd like to do today, is to update those. So Section 6 looks at eligibility, and what we'd be proposing is to change the eligible number of employees for a company to participate from 50 employees to 100 employees, so allowing more small businesses to take part in these low-interest loans. Also, we are asking that their after-tax profit be the definitive financial eligibility rather than having a net worth of $1 million. Again, we believe this will allow more small businesses to participate in this loan program. Then Section 7 deals with loan conditions, mainly the interest rate and the cap on the amount of loan that companies can get. So for the interest rate, the 1997 language was set the interest rate at 4% or one-half of the prime rate, whichever is greater. So I did some research, Mr. Chair. In the early 1990s, the prime rate was hovering around 10, 11%. In 1997, it was down to 8.5%. So saying 4% was a big drop from 8.5% or 10%. Today, though, the prime rate is 4.5%. So what we'd like to do is to keep the language saying that the interest rate for these loans is at or below one-half of the prime rate, not to exceed 5%. So, for example, today we could look at an interest rate of 2.25% because the prime rate is 4.5%. So then on line 8.22, we would like to increase the amount of loan a business can get from $50,000 to $75,000. So, Mr. Chairman, that we think this will keep up with modern financial times and interest rates and also allow more companies to participate in the Small Business Environmental Loan Program. And just for some context, since 2012, we have issued 21 loans to various small businesses. We're doing about 3 or 4 loans a year on average. Those 21 loans total $775,000 since 2012. So with that, I'll move on to Section 8, and I'm happy to take questions whenever people have them, Mr. Chairman. So Section
Ms. Gauthier, just give the group here just a real quick snapshot of what the loans are actually used for.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Okay. So the companies that we've loaned to since 2012 pretty much have been trucking companies and dry cleaning operations. So cleaners, transport companies, that's basically what we've looked at. There was, pretty much all since then are dry cleaners or transportation companies. I have the list I could provide to the committee, Mr. Chairman, if they would like it.
That's fine. Okay. Moving right along.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 8 is also an updating from language that is old. And this relates to Type 4 certification that we have for biosolid land applicators. So the current regulations for the certification of these biosolid land applicators were set in the 1980s, and they're located in Minnesota Rule Chapter 7048. So there's 5 types of certification dealing with different levels of waste. And what Type 4 certification is for land applicators of either biosolids from wastewater facilities or industrial byproducts coming out of industrial wastewater treatment plants like a food processor. There are currently about 670 Minnesotans who are certified as Type 4 biosolid land applicators. Right now, the current rule is for 9 hours of contact training or in-person training for these folks every 3 years to recertify. What we would like to do is change the 9 hours to 6 hours, and you can see that is required right on lines 8.24 through 8.26, and 6 hours every 3 years. The 9-hour existing training was set actually specifically in 1987. At that time, it was a brand new requirement. We had no training manuals. We had no one with the training that could mentor new folks who are getting into the business. We also had no internet. So now we have all those things. We have big training manuals. We have hundreds of people who could be mentors to new folks coming in. And we also have the internet where we can provide more information and assistance. But the people who take this training do believe the in-person contact training is very valuable, but we can get the work done in 1 day instead of two. So we would like to change it to 6 hours, and then these folks can reduce their costs they need to do now for lodging and meals because they have to stay overnight when they come for the training. So it would help municipalities save some money on that, and it brings it into line with the type three and type five certifications, which are also 6 hours. Remember I said there were five different types. So 3, 4, and 5 would all be 6 hours. Types 1 and 2 are for hazardous waste and the big, big landfills. Those require 18 hours of training every 3 years. So this is really a small change, but it would modernize this regulation and help municipalities and others save some expenses. So then starting on line 8.27 is a good cause exempt rulemaking to allow the agency to get this new change into the rules in quickly. Under good cause rulemaking, we can usually get those done in about 9 months, whereas our regular rulemaking takes 2 to 3 years. So that concludes our provisions in this year's MPCA technical and policy bill. I'm happy to stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Benke, you're sitting here. Do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, no, not unless there's any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Members, questions? Nice to see a reduction here in the mandates from 9 to 6. Anything else? Okay. Then I will renew my motion to send House File 3666 as amended to GovOps. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion's approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, members. Very good. 16 minutes to spare. Thank you all. We're adjourned.